It is said that when in Rome, one should do as the Romans do. The same could be said for what one should do when in China. And that leads us to ask, what can we learn by getting drunk in China?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1230th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Paphos who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, when in Chunghua, it's perfectly all right for a visitor from Meghua to get drunk, even during business dinners with very important clients. It's a tradition dating back some 9,000 years, give or take. Why, if you were to leave the dinner sober, your hosts might think they failed to show you the proper hospitality. And as a Meghua Ren, you will likely be expected to drink more than your Chunghua Ren hosts because there exists there a belief that Westerners can drink much more than Asians. It's also very important that you drink whatever your hosts offer. This is called Zhou Dan, which means drink courage. And the more of Zhou Dan you have, the more respect you gain. Of course, drinking all of this courage does not mean that you have Zhou Long, which is the ability to hold your drink. Then again, it's always a point of pride, wherever you are, to be able to hold your drink. And of course, it's most important that you have good Zhou Bin, which is to say, you behave yourself even though you are falling down drunk in China. This business dinner etiquette leads us to ask, what can we learn while drunk in China? Here to guide us through some 9,000 years of getting drunk in China, we have, from Jerusalem, Derek Sandhaus, who is the author of Drunk in China and co-founder of Ming River Sichuan by Zhou. Derek, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I'm happy to have you all the way from Jerusalem. So, 4 books on Chinese history and culture, the last by Zhou, the essential guide to Chinese spirits. So we wonder, how is it that a nice boy like you from Kansas City ends up becoming an expert in Chinese drinks and drinking?
Well, it happened in kind of a roundabout way. Right after I got out of college in the U.S., I moved to China in 2006 and lived in Shanghai for about 5 years. While I was living there, I became interested in Chinese history and culture and started working as an editor at a publishing house in Shanghai where I published my first few books, which were mostly focused on history. But as anyone who has lived in China for more than a few months can tell you, when you get invited out in a social situation like a business meeting or a wedding, you're going to be engaged in these banquets where a local grain alcohol called baijiu is always served. And so this drink, it's usually served in tiny little shot glasses. It's very strong, usually at least 50% alcohol by volume. And you drink a lot of it over the course of a meal when people toast you and you toast them back. So I'd experienced this just kind of naturally in the course of my life. I thought it was a very, very strong drink that had an unusual flavor that I wasn't very fond of at first. And I began asking a question while I was living in Shanghai, what is it about this drink that makes it so popular in China? And, you know, what am I missing about this? And I didn't really figure that out when I was living in Shanghai, but my wife, who is also American, she became a diplomat in the U.S. State Department. And her first posting was in Chengdu in southwestern China's Sichuan province. So While I was there, I quickly found out that Sichuan is like the Bourbon County of China. It's where over 70% of all the Chinese distilleries are located. So quite naturally, after I moved there, I started meeting all sorts of people who were working in the baijiu industry at various levels, and I became really curious about it and decided I was going to take this time when I was in a new place and trying to figure out what to do with myself to teach myself about Chinese drinks and the drinking culture that surrounds it.
Well, there you go. And also, Sichuan, of course, being the home of the world's best food, to my way of thinking, at any rate. So, food and drink, perfect place to end up. Much better than like Butte, Montana, though I love that place too. But, way back when there was a television commercial by Victor Kiam, who said, "I like the Remington razor so much, I bought the company." Was that what happened to you with respect to Baijiu? Since I see you're the co-founder of the Ming River Baijiu.
Yeah, so that happened in kind of a roundabout way. So I started out as a writer, like I said, and I traveled around China. I went to all of the different major production regions of Baijiu, tried to learn as much as I could about the different ways that they've made alcohol, both historically and currently, and just absorbed whatever I could, drank whatever I could for a couple of years. And I decided I was going to write this book about it, what became my most recent book, Drunk in China. I did my first draft of that book, I think, in 2012. And I pitched that to some publishers, and they came back to me and said, "This is really interesting, but nobody's going to read a book about a drink that nobody's ever heard of. So why don't you write instead a book that explains what Baijiu is to the world?" So that was my second to last book, Baijiu, The Essential Guide to Chinese Spirits. And so with that one, I kind of just made a very matter of fact by the numbers. This is the different styles of Baijiu. This is how they're made. Here are some of the most famous brands of Baijiu in China. And kind of created for the first time in English a way for people who didn't know anything about Chinese liquor to figure it out for themselves.
Then you went and bought the factory and
Right.
started.
So because I had written this book about Baijiu in English, before long, a lot of people started reaching out to me with various business propositions. For either taking Baijiu from China and selling it to people outside of China, or people from outside of China who wanted to get into the Baijiu business and wanted my help in doing so. So I did a little bit of consulting both ways, but I ended up teaming up with a group of guys who were running a cocktail bar that focused on Baijiu in Beijing, who are getting a lot of the same requests themselves. So we formed a consulting company, and soon after we founded this company, a distillery called Luzhou Lajiao from Sichuan, one of the biggest Baijiu producers in the country, reached out to us and said that they had been entertaining the idea of creating a Baijiu that would be an export product to get the rest of the world excited about Baijiu, and they thought we would be a good team to kind of, come up with the creative concept for this, because we were a bunch of non-Chinese who had spent a bunch of time in China, really liked Baijiu, and they thought we might have the passion and the ability to communicate what we liked about their product to the rest of the world. So that's how Ming River was born.
Good. And one of the major obstacles, of course, you're going to have to overcome is that first taste of Baijiu that those of us who are not familiar with it have when we take that first sip.
It can be quite shocking to the uninitiated palate.
Okay.
For a few reasons. And One thing that I should explain before we get too deep into Baijiu is that Baijiu in China just means white alcohol. So it's a term that's used like the word liquor is in the English language, where anything that is a distilled spirit is considered a liquor. And in China, anything that is a traditional Chinese liquor is considered a Baijiu. So what this means is there's different Baijiu's that are produced in different parts of China, and they can taste completely different from one another, as different as like whiskey, vodka, tequila, rum. And so what happens is people are introduced to something called Baijiu. Maybe they like it, maybe they don't, but that one thing in their mind often becomes the stand-in for this entire like diverse category of different drinks. And for foreigners in China, usually you're introduced to it in one of two ways. The first way is you go into a liquor store or like a convenience store, and you're looking at their Baijiu shelf, and you see there's some that cost, I don't know, $300, and there's some that cost $2. And you say to yourself, well, I don't know if I even like this stuff yet. I'll start with the $2 bottle.
And then you're guaranteed not to like it, right?
And surprise, surprise, it tastes like a $2 bottle of liquor. But then on the other end of the spectrum, a lot of people get introduced to Baijiu by their Chinese hosts while they're living or working in China. And oftentimes, their host will serve them that $300 bottle of Baijiu, which if you are accustomed drinking Baijiu and you're a real connoisseur, you're probably going to appreciate. But if you're not really familiar with the product, it might be too strong or too complex for you to take in. It's a lot like if you're drinking whiskey for the first time and someone serves you a really like smoky, peaty scotch. That's something if you drink a lot of whiskey, you're probably going to love. But if you're trying it for the first time, it's a strange flavor that's going to catch you off guard. So I think Baijiu is one of those things that really requires a little bit of guidance for someone who's trying for the first time, to pair you not with the cheapest or the most expensive, but something in the middle that's maybe most.
What exactly is Baijiu? When we say Baijiu, there's a root word there, which is Jiu. What is Jiu?
So Jiu is a word that several thousand years ago referred to a specific drink that was invented in prehistoric China. And this was a drink that's made basically from grains that are steamed and then come into contact with some like natural microorganisms like yeast and mold and get turned into a very like strong, flavorful, almost somewhere between like a beer and a wine. So that was Jiu in ancient times, but over time, Jiu became a word that just referred to any type of alcohol because it was the root alcohol of all East Asian drinks.
And then there are variations of that, right?
Right. So today we say like a fermented traditional Chinese beverage made from grains, usually rice, but sometimes also millet, is called a huangzhou or a yellow alcohol. And a baijiu or a white alcohol is a distilled spirit. But you have other things like a putaozhou, which is a grape wine, or pijiu, which is beer.
There you go.
So in any type of alcohol in China uses jiu as its root word.
There you go. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to go back 9,000 years, way back, and talk about the beginnings of the drinking culture in China, which dates way, way back and goes all the way up to today. So we're going to take a wild ride through Chinese history with Derek Sandhouse, and you do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Only today, it's not what's eating what, it's who's drinking what, and it's us, and we're drinking up China with Derek Sandhouse, the author of Drunk in China. And Eric, how did you come up with such a beautiful name, such a graceful name for a book on drinking in China?
Well, as a writer, I think whenever you can land a quadruple entendre, you have to do it. And for me, the title was one of the first things that kind of sparked this project for me. Because I'd been living in China, I'd been experiencing the drinking culture, not totally understanding the nuance of it, but really wanting to figure it out. So I thought it would be a fun idea for a book to kind of step away from my usual writing about Chinese history to do something a little more personal, a little more travel-based, and seeing what it would be like to travel around the country, knocking on the doors of major distilleries, and learning from distillers and winemakers about that culture firsthand. So that was the idea from the beginning, but the longer the project went on, the more it morphed into a project that covered history and society and politics.
Yeah, it's kind of it's kind of like a Moby Dick of drinking in China.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a bit more of a project than I imagined when I started it, but one that has kept my interest for much longer than I expected.
Well, now you a history fan too. You wrote a couple of histories of China, mm-hmm. So that's a good place to start because it really gives people a sense of the depth of the Chinese culture. You know, here in the United States, we're a couple hundred years old. Here in the United States, we don't tend to think of things in long terms as we do, in China, where history is so deep. So take us back, you know, to what, 7,000 years before the Common Era in Jiahu, near the Yellow River.
Mm-hmm. So the earliest known Chinese alcohol was discovered in the 1980s in an archaeological site near the Yellow River in a place called Jiahu in Hunan province. So this was discovered by a Chinese team who worked with an American archaeologist by the name of Patrick McGovern to analyze some pottery shards that they found at this ancient site. And what they discovered analyzing these fragments was that the pottery vessels that people had been buried with in Jiahu contained traces of a man-made alcohol. And it turned out to be the oldest known alcohol found anywhere in the world. And it was quite an interesting and unusual alcohol in what it told us about Chinese history, because there were a few things in this drink. There was hawthorn fruit, there was honey, and there was grapes, and there was some wild rice. So first of all, if there's grain, honey, and grapes in there, you have some of the oldest, not just alcohols, but evidence that both, like, you know, beer, mead, grape wine, all of that goes back to the very beginning of human history. And then you also have that wild rice in there. And that's fascinating because it indicates that the Chinese didn't start consuming rice as a food source, but as a source of alcohol. And that they actually domesticated that crop to make more alcohol as opposed to, as you know, using rice as the staple crop that it is today.
Well, let's carry that thought ahead, because in making alcohol, it gave people the ability to move into town, right?
We think so. I mean, it's very hard to say what order things played out, but there's definitely a theory among some people who study the ancient world that it's called the, I believe, a beer before bread theory, that humans began settling in agricultural communities instead of being hunter-gatherer nomads because they wanted to have a stable source for producing alcohol, which is believed to have been very important in the religious rituals of the ancient world. Certainly in China, some of the earliest historical texts that we have from, you know, 1-2000 BC, those histories say that the ancient religions in China, at least, revolved around sacrifices, making offerings to the gods and the spirits. And one of the most popular ones was what's called the corpse ritual, where the corpse sacrifice, where someone who, you know, died, who was important in a community, they would commemorate that person's memory by having a relative spend about a week fasting and meditating on the recently departed. And then at the end of a week, the community would be called together, and the chief or the shaman or whoever the authority figure was would make an offering of wine by pouring some wine on the floor. And once they poured the wine on the floor, the smell of the alcohol was supposed to lift up into the heavens and call the spirit of the dead into the body of the person who had been meditating. And the leader would make a toast to them, and then the spirit would take the cup and drink three glasses in return to show that they accepted the sacrifice. And then the wife of the leader would make a toast, and the spirit would take three. And then, you know, the ministers would make the toast. And the belief is that this person who had been fasting for a week and was taking drinks at a 3-to-1 ratio would become so drunk that they actually began hallucinating and actually thought that they entered into the spirit realm and were the spirit of the dead, that the drunkenness was a way of the spirit world invading the mortal realm.
There you go. Whatever works, whatever gets the job done, I guess, right? But the other thing, the other significant thing about alcohol was that it was the one safe thing to drink. And when you put a bunch of people together, things tend to get dirty real quick. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, with waste and whatnot, where do you get your water? Where do you get safe water? So having alcohol to drink was probably not only, you know, a religious ritual, but it's probably a life-saving thing to do. But at any rate, having that alcohol really did bring people together.
Well, I do just want to like briefly interrupt that comment. Sure. Because one of the like crucial differences between alcohol in China and in the like Western world in the Mediterranean and the Middle East was that very early on in Chinese history, people began drinking boiled water, which purified the water in such a way that whereas beer and wine were the stable drink, you know, that you would be having all times of day, every day in the Western world up until, you know, just a couple hundred years ago. In China, very early on, they had a clean source of water to drink in the form of boiled water and later tea. So they never had alcohol become the everyday drink that it was in other parts of the world, and it became viewed more as a luxury product in China rather than something you needed to survive.
Well, at any rate, they did develop a civilization, and booze seemed to be a big helping hand in that development. Certainly. So take us to the three ancient dynasties and how they learned how to tax alcohol.
Well, so, you know, the three ancient dynasties in China are like the Sha, the Shang, and the Zhou. And those are, you know, mostly like mythical. Like, we don't know a whole lot about them. They existed, you know, let me see, when the oldest of them was about, you know, supposedly started about 2000 BC. And went right up until, you know, close to, you know, 200 or 300 BC. So these ancient dynasties were a period that much mythology is drawn from in China. Most of the legends and the heroic emperors come from this period, but we don't know how much of it is based in reality, because a lot of it predates the written language as it exists today. So certainly the later the time went on, the closer it became to, you know, something that we can trust. But what did happen during this time that's important is that the Chinese developed kind of a bureaucracy and a centralized government. And most of the courts of these ancient dynasties began having many, many officials whose job it was to produce different kinds of alcohol for different rituals. So long before a lot of parts of the world had a very sophisticated winemaking tradition, China did develop some techniques that were quite unusual. And the most important thing to happen during these ancient dynasties was the invention of something called Chu, which is spelled Q-U. And this is essentially it's a grain-based culture, usually made from rice or wheat, that is mixed with water and allowed to kind of naturally decompose and absorb different microorganisms from the air, usually mold, yeast, and bacteria. And if you mix Chu together with any source of starch, it will interact with the starch in such a way that it begins to ferment and turn into alcohol. And using a process that is similar to how we make alcohol outside of China, but unique in several different respects in terms of what the final product is like. So whereas, like, I guess with like a Western grain alcohol, like a beer, you have to first convert the starch in the grain into sugar and then add yeast to that. The mold and the yeast in Chu combines to do those two processes at the same time. So Chinese drinks using this technique were both a little bit stronger than alcohol that you would find in other parts of the world, but they also had a bit more like complexity and flavor than many of the ancient drinks that were consumed elsewhere. So this is a technique that influenced all Chinese food that came after it too. So most fermented Chinese products, everything from, you know, pickled fruits and vegetables to
soy sauce and vinegar,
tofu. Most of the flavors of the Chinese kitchen come back to this very ancient winemaking ingredient called Chu.
Wow. Okay. During this time, you talk a lot about the troubles that the kingdoms had, the emperors, the rise and fall of dynasties, largely being caused by too much drinking.
Certainly that was the spin put upon it by the historians who came after. So both the Xia and the Shang dynasty, the first two of these ancient dynasties, the histories say the last rulers of both of these dynasties became kind of problem drinkers, for lack of a better word. They spent all of their time drinking and cavorting with women and neglected their official responsibilities to the point that their dynasties collapsed. But it's hard to say how much of that is true or how much of that is the dynasty that came after it rewriting history to justify their overthrow
of as that they government. as they tend to do
yeah,
and
know,
along
the,
and along around
this is
along around 551 comes Confucius to kind of ring this stuff to put order on the drinking and putting it in ceremonial situations rather than free drinking. Did I read that correctly?
So as I'd mentioned before, much of the drinking in ancient China was viewed as part of religious rituals or rites that would justify the place of humans and kingdoms in the cosmic order. So Confucius was building upon pre-existing rituals and rites, but his philosophy was one of like the belief was that if you cultivated humans with the right education and the right manners, you could make a better functioning society. And a big part of that was everyone has like a role to play within that society. Rulers, you know, of course, their obligation is to provide for their people, but subjects, their role is to follow the rules that are laid down for them by their leaders. So with Confucius, he said in terms of alcohol that it was fine to drink, that you should, you know, have alcohol for primarily its symbolic and ritualistic purposes, but that you shouldn't ever drink so much that you lose control of yourself. And, you know.
Yeah, and with that, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we want to talk about a little bit about the Taoist, who kind of represented the other side of that equation on perhaps you should drink too much, perhaps you should have fun, and perhaps you should cut loose. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Drinking What? With Derek Sandhaus, the author of Drunk in China.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Confucius laid down the law and told us how we should go about doing things, and a lot of people have been following him for a long, long time. And yet there were some people that came after them, a Taoist, who had a slightly different perspective on how they should, how we should enjoy drinking. And when I was studying Chinese literature some many years ago, I ran into a poet that completely captivated me. His name was Li Bo, and you call him Li Bai. The same guy?
Yeah, Li Bai or Li Tai Bai, sometimes rendered Li Po in the romanization the older romanization of his name is Li Po. So
I guess I dated myself.
Many people still refer to him by that name. So it's like the philosopher that we were just discussing, Confucius, in Chinese is Kongzi. Li Bai, he was a poet who was born around 700 AD during the Tang Dynasty. And he's today remembered as one of the kind of seminal Chinese poets, considered by some to be the greatest Chinese poet who ever lived. Which is kind of interesting because the Tang Dynasty was a very cosmopolitan dynasty that had trade and relations with people all over the known world at the time. And a reflection of that is that Li Bai is believed by many today to have been, if not half foreign, entirely foreign, perhaps from Kyrgyzstan or Afghanistan.
Oh.
So he had a very international background. He grew up in Sichuan, and he's famous not just as a great poet, but also as one of the best drinkers in Chinese history. Many of his poems are about alcohol, and a lot of the stories of his life involve him getting riotously drunk in inappropriate circumstances. So he's a hero both to poets, to drinkers, but his
and young college students.
He's quite a remarkable poet, and a lot of the themes he explores come from Taoism, which is kind of the opposite end of the ideological spectrum from Confucianism, in that it doesn't so much rely on following orders, but finding ways to kind of tune out of society and forget the orders. And so there's a long, proud tradition among artists in China, and particularly poets and writers, of using alcohol as a way of kind of achieving this, mystical state of forgetting oneself by, you know, essentially dumbing down the senses, getting drunk, forgetting what you're supposed to be and becoming the person that you actually are, kind of a you know, the Chinese version of the Roman in vino veritas.
There you go.
In wine truth.
And that takes us to modern times when Derek Sandhouse is visiting Xinjiang, and you're going to, I don't know what you were doing in Xinjiang anyway. What were you doing there?
Okay, so this is a town in Hunan, Xinjiang, and it's a place that wasn't on my map at all when I started out this journey. But I knew I wanted to go to Hunan because I wanted to go to the archaeological museum there and see these relics of that like 7,000 BC culture.
So that's where it all started.
Where it all started, exactly. I wanted, while I was traveling around China, to be sure that that would be a stop on the list. So I had stopped in Shanghai about a week before I got to Hunan, and I went to my old office, and I was talking to an old coworker who is a Chinese-American woman, and her family came from this town in Hunan. And she said, if you're going to be out in Hunan, you should go stop in this town and meet my uncle. And I said, why should I do that? And she said, well, he, you know, loves Baijiu. I'm sure he'd be happy to talk with you. And he gave me my first sip of Baijiu, I think, when I was 7 years old. I said, yeah, I got to meet this guy. So I called him up, and he and his wife kind of met me at the bus station when I got there and took me under their wing for a couple of days, took me to some wonderful historical sites. And of course, we drank a lot of Baijiu together.
And what really fascinated me was the story of them taking you out to dinner. And mm-hmm. there was the uncle and the aunt. And there was a lady you called Curly, and a party official there as well. So if you could tell us about how that dinner went, I think we could learn a lot about the whole context of that Chinese drinking culture. So how were you seated? Let's start there.
Sure. So one thing that's very, I think, wonderful about being a visitor in China is that you're often treated with a tremendous amount of respect and honor, especially when, you know, it's Chinese hospitality is a very, very important thing in social life there. So when you're seated as a guest of honor, you are seated at the table that has the best line of sight to the door. So oftentimes when you're out at a banquet, you'll be at this big round table with a lazy Susan in the middle. And a lot of people mistakenly think, you know, oh, it's a round table. Everyone is equal. It's like, no, of course not. the person who can see everyone coming and going from the room, they're the most important, because their job in a traditional banquet is that of the host. Where they are supposed to make sure everyone is well fed and well lubricated. So if you're in that seat, you technically can tell people when they should drink.
Where you sit is very important, and you had the guest of honor seat because you're mm-hmm. a foreigner, so you had the guest of honor. And the auntie asked you if you would like to eat something, if you could eat something spicy.
Yeah, so I made a series of mistakes during that meal that I probably, in retrospect, should have seen coming. And I'd been in China long enough that I just wasn't thinking enough. So, yeah, she asked, you know, if I could eat spicy food, and that's fine. I love spicy food. I love the food of Sichuan, Hunan, which has some of the spiciest food in China, one of my favorites. So I was ready for that. And then she, you know, asked, like, is there anything you don't eat? And I said, no, I'll eat everything. So, of course, the first thing that lands on the table is a giant plate of silkworms. And I don't mind eating insects all that much. It happens every once in a while in China. They kind of taste crunchy, you know, like chips or something. Nothing particularly exciting or scary about them. And then the topic came to my drinking tolerance later. And I had been traveling around the country, meeting with various distilleries. I said, you know, how much can you drink? And I said, you know, well, you know, just last week I was at this distillery. Me and this other guy, we drank a bottle ourselves. And they're like, oh, you can drink a lot. So they ordered another bottle of Baijiu immediately, even though I'd had way more than I needed to drink. And as you mentioned, many of the people I was seating with were, you know, they were trying to give me the royal treatment. They were kind of minor party officials in the local government. And they didn't, I think, get a lot of foreign visitors. So they asked me, you know, were about my interests throughout the meal. And I was told them I had a, you know, my wife and dog were back in Sichuan, and one of my hosts said, oh, you like dogs? And I was like, yeah, I love dogs. They're great. And so she said, like, do you want to go, you know, see my dogs after dinner? And I said, sure, why not? Let's do it. And so we piled in this van and we go out into the countryside. We pull up to this big kind of courtyard style house. And in this courtyard, on all sides are these giant Tibetan mastiffs, these just terrifyingly large, vicious, vicious guard dogs that are barking bloody murder at me. And it was a bit of a intimidating situation, especially I went up to one of them to see the puppies, and the mother of one of the puppies jumped, I think, like 5 or 6 feet in the air over a fence. Thankfully not landing on my side of the fence, but enough to let me know I wasn't entirely safe in that setting. And it was one of the more memorable nights I had.
Always those to make the traveling fun, right? Those little bits of unexpected things.
Yeah.
You know, one of the most fascinating parts of your work was your discussion of the Ganbai culture of drinking, which is to say where you toast each other. And the importance of that culture in a business meeting setting, where would you kind of go through the rituals of that that toasting process is? Because, you know, when we see Nixon goes to China, we see him doing toasts and we think, well, they're toasting, but it's a very structured ritual.
So, yeah. So usually in China, everyone has a shot glass in front of them at the dinner table. And these aren't the Western size shot glasses. These are maybe a quarter of the size. Very tiny glasses, but the Baijiu, remember, is usually about 50% alcohol by volume. So even at a, you know, at a small pour, those shots can add up pretty quickly. And the idea of like a Chinese banquet, how drinking happens there, is usually the host, the person in the seat of honor will make a welcoming toast in which they thank the guests for coming and talk about how happy they are to share this meal with them. And then everyone, you know, says ganbei, which means dry the glass. And you do just that. You drink the entire shot. And then maybe one or two more group toasts will happen. And then anyone at the table can, at any point of the meal after that, make a toast to someone else. And you're always supposed to, you know, do this to kind of both demonstrate your respect to them, but to, you know, kind of show that you're all in it together. And anytime you toast someone at one of these meals, they are required to toast you back to be polite to you and show you the same respect. So you can see very quickly that if you're at a table with 15, 20 people, you can end up doing, you know, 30, 40, 50 shots of these drinks quite quickly. And the affair can become incredibly loud and drunk before before the meal concludes. So it's not uncommon in China to see people leaving a restaurant just staggeringly drunk. But because it is part of this, hospitality culture, it's not viewed the same way as it is in America, where if you saw someone who was stumbling drunk, you would say, like, oh, what a drunk. In China, you say, like, you know, wow, that's someone who's been out for a great night on the town. They're successful businessmen, just closed the deal. There's a completely different connotation to being drunk with your friends in China.
Wow. So it really is true then being drunk in China is not something to be looked down on. It's something kind of a celebratory thing where you've done good.
Yes. Yes and no. There's a dark side to it as well. There's also the problem of this is often used as kind of, for lack of a better word, as a bit of a pissing contest where, you know, oftentimes people will push others to drink more than they're comfortable with to show, you know, to demonstrate that you're, you know, usually it's men, that you're a man's man and that you've got a strong tolerance and that you can drink more than anyone else. And that can lead to pretty dangerous habits as well. There's also, you know, doing it to kind of break people down as well. Like
sure.
there's a notion.
Get the information and get an advantage
yeah, yeah.
on somebody. Sure.
It happens in business settings. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So often the goal is to like make the person you're negotiating with drop their guard and spill the beans.
And fall on the floor. Absolutely. Well, that goes without saying in any culture. That's what alcohol is used for. But I have just a few seconds left, actually, and wanted to ask you one very significant question. Have you, Derek Sandhouse, ever eaten bat soup?
I have not. I've spent a lot of time in China. I've seen the news reports about weird food that they eat in China, and I think mostly this is this is. Oh, did I go too far?
No, but it's just we ran out of time. I just wanted to say thank you, Derek Sandhouse, for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
The book, Drunk in China, so much there, enjoy it. And remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.